podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
It is the Anfield Wrap. Neil Atkinson hosting, Neil Docking. I've got Mo Stewart as well. I've got Paul Johnson. Producing is Andy Heaton, and he is going to cut across us because the Champions League draw is happening as we talk. We're going to talk as well about Spurs and about the game coming up against Derby. Tottenham 1, Liverpool 2 though, Paul. Very much put a spring in my step this morning as I woke up. It was a good time to play them, let's be clear, but we very much did play them in that first half especially. Liverpool were good and they got what they deserved.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, like you said, with about sort of 10 to go, my friend turned to me and said, you know, if we don't win this, we'll be devastated. And we would have been absolutely devastated, because, you know, you wake up the next day and you feel like you're a new man. You're looking forward to the next game as opposed to, you know, counting down because you wanted a reaction to what's gone before. So I think it was a good time to play them. Like you said, Neil, it was, you know, they we can look at them probably a little bit later on where they are at the moment. But sometimes we've had a bit of luck, and, you know, when you play a team, you can say it's a good time to play them. And it was for Spurs yesterday. And, you know, and it's just great when you wake up this morning, you think, you know, great result. And, you know, we're looking forward to the next one now.
So, go on. Andy?
Yeah.
Go on.
Turning the mic on. I'm just going to go Real Madrid.
Sounds okay. Yeah. Take it all day.
I can hope by the pained express.
No. I'm into it. There was obviously pros to getting a lesser side, but there's a couple of things here. One is, well, I'd rather have them over two legs than in the fucking final.
Exactly.
Number one.
Exactly.
But also number two for me was, if ever there's a decent year, because it's going to be intense stuff trying to come top four because of the position we put ourselves in. If we go out last 16, then, you know, we're freed up to go a game a week and all of that sort of stuff. So I'm Neil Docking, Real Madrid. As I say, we beat them, and I think we become de facto favourites for the Champions League. So let's just fucking get it all out in the open now.
Well, if you're going to win the Champions League,
you drains up.
Yeah, you've got to beat Real Madrid. Mm-hmm. Like, we've seen that over the last 4 or 5 years. You literally have to beat them at some stage if you're going to lift a big thing. You know, that's the way it is. So they're obviously a fabulous team with so much experience. I wouldn't want to play them again in a one-off final. If we got them in the final again, I think I'd be very, very nervous going into it. This way we get them to Anfield. It's a shame that, you know, the first leg's at Anfield and we can't get them back second leg. But, I really, really fancy our chances, a big European night of turning them over, and we'll see what we can do out there.
Spring in your step, Paul. Said before about the result yesterday. Now you've got to spring in your step about the fact that it is Real Madrid. You'll be looking forward to February. It's a massive game at Anfield.
Do you know what? I don't want to go Mo Salah.
You've got to twat them.
Yeah, well, I just think, Mo, there was a lot of talk about revenge and et cetera, you know, before we played them in Paris. And, you know, you could say, oh, maybe you shouldn't have said anything. But I sit here now and I think we owe them. We've got Kiev there. And I don't want to build that up and say, you know, put too much on it. But I genuinely think it's probably, as you both said already, it's better getting them over two legs. Mm-hmm. And I just think that at some point, yeah, we do need to do them. So let it be February.
Yeah, no, you're right. We are going to have to beat them to win the Champions League. That's true. I'd have still rather done it later. I'm not going to lie. But yeah, there are positives to take from getting them now. Obviously, they're a team that are going to have loads of players in the World Cup.
Yep.
So we don't know how that's going to shake up what's going on there. But yeah, in a way, I'm actually better off with us having the home leg first. I think when we are kind of underdoggy like that, I think it actually suits us to go out there and sit the marker down rather than have to be hold out and be negative in the first leg and then hope to bring it all back in the second one. No, be positive from the go. Try get a lead and then go out there and do the job. It's not going to be easy. I'm annoyed.
Anfield's
well.
Going to be great, though. It's going to be amazing.
I mean, I think I'd be less annoyed if I didn't see that Benfica have got Bruges. And it's just like,
get them in the last 8, Mo.
Yeah, fair play.
That's isn't that done in the last 8? It opens up the last 8 for us. That's what that suits us down to the ground. The year we won it, we had Munich home.
That's
and
true.
Away. And then it was Porto last 8.
Yep.
So, you know, I'm up for, and also it'd be more intense the last 8 for our league picture. So I'd like an easier fixture then, because we're on the march in the league at that point, Mo. Let's accentuate the positives.
Okay, you're true. Well, if we accentuate positives, the last time we finished second in the group was also the last time we won the Champions League.
Mm-hmm. There
so.
You are.
Yeah.
All right, yeah, fine. Let's do it.
Honestly, I'll play them tomorrow. Let's do it. Let's not mess about.
Do you know, and the other thing is, I know by that time, hopefully we're in a better position. But in terms of the moment, you know, we got City and we beat them. And then we go and get beat by Forest and Leeds. So
and then we beat Napoli, and then we
exactly.
beat Tottenham.
Exactly. And so it's almost like when we got beat by Leeds last Saturday, I walked back to my mum's house and said, oh, it's a guarantee that we'll beat Spurs next week, because that seems to be where we are at the moment. So in a way, I think I'd rather have Real Madrid than maybe get one of these lesser teams, because I say,
that's the spirit.
Anfield will be up for it, won't it? Anfield will be up for it. And who knows where we'll be in, you know, some players back, Diaz, Jota, believe like that. So yeah, let's have it.
Yeah, I mean, I still obviously cling to the Benitez years. The 4-1, 4-0
4-0 1-0 from the first
1-0 out there, 4-0 at home was just one of the best double headers ever under Rafa, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Fantastic. And we were all so disappointed how meek and mild we were against them under Rodgers in the Champions League campaign that should never be spoken of again. And then when we've lost to them without a crowd, you know, in two dead fixtures, one of them at their training ground, I've already cast that from my memory.
Yep, doesn't count.
They have an incredible amount of quality.
And experience.
Know-how. Certainly in midfield, their midfield is frightening.
Should be our midfield.
it's frightening. So we'd have to be at our very, very best to beat them. But the other thing is, it's February. It's such a long time away.
And there's a whole other thing that happens in the game.
Yeah, I remember a few years ago when we played Bayern, there was all this talk that Bayern were in tatters, I think, when we drew them. And then when we played them, they were top of the league and they were flying high. So you can't really draw too much from a current state of play.
No.
And anything happened, cup competition, all the cliches. I'm really, really looking forward to this. And it's huge, isn't it? It's just a massive tie. You know, the two top dogs in Europe going head-to-head. European royalty.
One thing I would say to anyone who is feeling a little bit disappointed, I've shaken it off by now, by the way. You guys are brilliant for that. Anyone who is still feeling a bit disappointed, think of it this way. We could be Barcelona and in the Europa League.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So it could be, it's either after Everton, or either between Everton and Newcastle, the first leg, or between Newcastle and Palace. And then the second leg is either between Man United and Bournemouth, or it is between Bournemouth and either the FA Cup quarterfinal or Fulham at home. That's when the second legs are. So the first legs, 14th or 15th of February, 21st or 22nd of February, and the second leg, 7th or 8th of March, and the 14th or 15th of March. Plan your life accordingly. Actually kicks onto a couple of holiday plans. I've got that. You know, one of them. the listeners to this are the first to know, well ahead of my wife, so if we can keep it between us, that'd be marvellous. All right, then.
Which is beautiful this time of year.
When we get close to the end, Andy will give us the full draw and we can have a chat about it in full. I think he mouthed to me Bayern versus PSG, which someone's going out in the same way that they'll have looked at ours and gone, someone's going out, and then you end up with a Benfica Bruges sort of scenario, and we'll go from there.
Am I mixed up that? Do we get that?
No.
You know you're playing, so it's only for this one is a free draw, and then it's after, you know, right.
Quarterfinals and semis are safe.
Pull themselves together. Let's get back to it then. Tottenham 1, Liverpool 2, Mo. I've said it's a good time to play them, and I think it was, because until Kulusevski comes on, they're all muscle and very little guile. And I think in general that is the criticism there is going round of Conte's Tottenham side this season from Tottenham supporters. And we just got to see it. And I think that's part of the reason why, you know, it's a great, in a game sense, it's a great start from Liverpool, because when we can hurt them, we hurt them.
Yeah, we do. And I think the noticeable thing about it is the lack of pace that they had as well, because that was really what killed us when we played against Spurs in previous times, is that they were able to soak up and then spring. But this time they didn't have any
spring whatsoever.
And so that made our job so much easier. But also, aside from that, we had a plan for them, getting in between the right-hand wing-back and the right-hand centre-back. So we were anticipating the fact that they were going to try and flatten it out as much as possible, have a 5-3-2. And you saw it so obviously. I mean, for those people who don't necessarily pay attention to formations and stuff like that, you can see it clear as day in this game. They were there. And exactly how
no one was between the lines. No. The lines were the lines.
Exactly how they were drawn up on the tactics board. And because of that, it meant that when we were making our moves, we knew exactly how they would respond. And yeah, it's funny. We've gone into this game thinking Liverpool needs to start well. We haven't started well, really well. We've been going 1-0 down a lot. Tottenham were saying the same thing, and they were shorn of some of their best players. So I felt like it was one of those where the opportunity was there to take an early advantage, and I'm really glad that we did take it.
On that, Mo, what I thought was really interesting watching it on the telly was you got to see there's almost something almost childlike about the manager's reaction to the second. Like, he very rarely celebrates like that these days.
But he celebrated the exact same way I did in my living room. Yeah. Like a flurry of punches down by your waist.
I think that was telling in terms of I think he thought we've won this now because we've got two ahead now. I think it ends up tense towards the end of the game, but I think he was thinking, right, you've got the first one, but we need to capitalise and get the other. And there was, as I say, it was gleeful in a way that he very rarely is these days when he celebrates, and I thought that was very telling.
Well, in the commentary, they mentioned the fact that Spurs will be better in the second half within 2 minutes of the game kicking off. So everybody knew that that's what was going to happen. So getting that cushion of two goals allows you for them to get the goal back and you to still have a lead and still be able to hold off. And that's exactly what we did. I mean, we had to ride our luck a few times, but we've been there so many times before where Liverpool haven't capitalised when they're on top. And those tend to be the ones where the results are disappointing. Mm-hmm. The ones where we score the goals that are kind of dominance demands, those are the ones we do well. And the beauty of that one is it was just after a period of Spurs pressure. So we'd held off them and then gone and hit them. And at that time, and because of the nature of the goal, let's face it, Eric Dyer didn't exactly cover himself in glory.
No.
So you've got...
Covered himself in gunge.
I love that. So yeah, you've got that, and then you've got half-time. So it just allows everybody's game plan to... Whatever Conte was going to say to his guys, he's just going to have to change it. So much of our game plan was get that lead and then be able to hold off, and that's what happened.
We don't kill it, which... I think it's a knife edge at 2-0. I really do. I think either side could have scored at 2-0. I think that they're more on top, but you feel as though we can hit on the break. And I think if we'd have gone 3, you know, I think it wouldn't have surprised me if it actually got a bit daft, because I think that they were on the ragged edge, even at 2-0.
They were stretched, weren't they?
They were really stretched, and, you know, it could have gone from there. In the end, we do, for say, ride our luck a little bit. We do have to defend robustly. We do have to show real resilience at 2-1. But the big thing for me, Neil, is, God, we show it. Oh, and that's why, you know, again, you'd have carried... I don't think they all play well, and I want to come on to talk about that. By any stretch of the imagination, I don't think they all play well, but you'd have carried every single one of them aloft off the pitch at the end, because they were so, so determined, so focused that they were getting these 3 points.
Determination was the key word, wasn't it? They were utterly resolute. You could see, I thought, in the post-match interviews when they spoke to Tony Robertson, he was talking about that. They knew that they'd earned the points. They'd really put a shift in for us. Like you say, at 2-0, it is on a knife edge. It's almost a chance for a carbon copy of the first goal, isn't there, with Nunes and Salah? And obviously, it wasn't the easiest of chances. If he'd have scored, it would have been another stellar finish from Mo. But like you say, if it had gone 3-0, then it could have been a cricket score. But when we did have to dig in, we restricted them to very few clear-cut chances.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's one from a set piece.
Which is just after it's gone 2-1 as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And their tails are up. And in a funny way, I thought that they were all over us in the build-up to their goal, all over us. And then we've seen this before when actually, as you said, the worst things happen. You concede and you almost reset and then go again. And we actually recovered really, really well. And during that spell, Konate was imperious. I mean, all throughout the game, the amount of duels he wins, the amount of clearances he makes are all records for us either in that game or this season. He's such a key figure in that spell. But everyone, the big man next to him as well, Virgil, dug in. I thought that it was a performance to be really proud of. Like you say, there were mistakes, there were errors, it was far from perfect. If they had have equalised, I don't think we could all be sat here saying, that's totally unjust.
Yep. You know,
but at the same time, I did think we deserved to win that match, and we did.
Yeah, when you were saying it being on a knife edge in the pub, it felt like, and it's always, it's, you know, a thing that's been said a lot, at 2-0, next goal was crucial. It felt like that, didn't it, as well? So when they score it, I must admit, I was fearing the worst, but it was fantastic the way they did dig in, because I think that's been missing, hasn't it? That's when maybe one thing where, you know, when we were 1-1 against Leeds and you think, well, come on, Reg, we need to just dig in here and go and get that winner, and then it ends up going the other way. I think that's been missing. That's been one of, obviously, the big criticisms, that, you know, that fight that you want to see, because you can, like you said there, the quality still wasn't brilliant by some of our players, but they fought. And as a fan, I think that's one thing that we've always felt. Well, as long as your team's fighting for you, which they've been so good at, haven't they, over the last few years as well?
For a good example of that, you know, we'll start there. We can start with them. Like, I thought Thiago was rubbish.
Yes.
For much of the game, I thought he was rubbish. But my God, did he fight. Mm. And he battled and he won his tackles. Yeah. And, you know, he's rolling around on the deck at some point. And it's not the glorious sort of, you know, half his shin pads are out and he's swaggering around the place, his shorts rolled up performance. It was, no, we win today.
Yeah.
And so I ended up loving his performance in a way where, because he was rubbish, he was part of the process of getting Liverpool through.
I was just going to say that, did you see when Klopp bristled in a press conference last week, I think it was, where a reporter put to him, sometimes in some of the games there's not been enough fight?
Yeah.
And he literally responded to the reporter, well, which ones? And the reporter was sort of fumbling and I think responded, said, well, about Forest. But a lack of fight hasn't been the issue. It's been a lack of capability at times, a lack of quality. But it's not at no stage this season have I thought, oh, they're not putting it in or they're being lazy. Sometimes it's been the players physically aren't on the pitch who give us what we need in this moment.
And I've seen people say that, and I'm like you, I kind of push back against it, because you can tell in the moments where the difference between desire and literally having no gas. Where it's just like the times when the ball's gone past them and the heads instantly drop, it's just like, I know, I'm not going to have it in me to chase this back. That's a very different thing. Thiago, I think it was so interesting for me, because we all saw the way he plays. He has a certain arrogance on the ball. That's kind of his game. Like, it's in order to kind of draw the opponents in, he's got to make you think almost like he's not really paying attention, being a bit like today's goal, and then he goes past you. The problem is sometimes he is just like today's goal, and you noticed it, and he clearly noticed it, but he was like you're saying, he was just like, I'm still going to be able to affect this game. And the defensive side of it, to be able to read where to be at the right time, and sometimes when he's tackling back, particularly when he's coming from a long distance, you watch him and you think, this is going to be a foul. And that was none of that on Sunday. He was just so surgical in how he went in and got it.
There's a couple of crucial ones right on the edge of the area more as well, where if they had a mistimed or give a free kick away, it was a really dangerous area. But as you say, he timed it well and it was a crucial tackle. So, I think, like you said, the part of the game that we all expect from Thiago, it wasn't necessarily there, but the other side of it was great to see, you know, because obviously it's a crucial part when you're playing centre mid and the chips are down almost.
I saw some heat maps. A friend of mine sent me some heat maps, which I don't often look at, but I knew I was coming on this show, so I'll have a look at some heat maps. And he tracks back a lot. The ground he covers defensively, Thiago, you can see, certainly in comparison to Elliot on the opposite flank, he's a lot more in defensive areas. Firmino's doing an extraordinary amount of work from side to side, not always effective, but covering a lot of ground side to side. Nunes pushed up so high on the left as well, so there's more reliance on Thiago to cover a greater area behind him. Like you say, it wasn't always pretty from Thiago, but he does affect the match.
I think on that as well, Neil, I think Elliot has a bit of a tough trot too. And where this leads me is to therefore say, well, Fabinho must have played well. And I think that Fabinho did play well. I think it could be his best performance of the season for us. Felt like he was more comfortable again. I think he enjoyed the shape, the system. I think he enjoys that patrolling in that area, being able to see the game in front of him. So, you know, as I say, I think Elliot at times, there's a funny thing about the press, and the press is really good, but then the winning the ball isn't. So he presses really well, but I think sides are beginning to go, it's all right if this fella presses me, because you're not very good at tackling me. And that's a bit of a problem for us, and it'll come out over time. But I think within all of that, you're able to say Fabinho, really good game, and I'm pleased for him.
Yeah, 100%. On the heat map, as I say, Fabinho covers an immense amount of ground. The familiarity and the solidity that this shape gives us obviously suits him compared to the switch that we've made mid-season. He is more comfortable. He's not the quickest. And at times, you know, he's going to struggle to get to people. So he needs to have that support and he needs to close the gaps in advance so he doesn't give himself an impossible task. It's what I was saying earlier about capability. Sometimes it's not that he doesn't want to get there, he just physically can't get there. But we managed to accentuate his game. I do have some concerns about Harvey at this stage in his development on the right-hand side of a three and the knock-on effect it has for other positions and other players such as Trent. I do look at Harvey and I see someone who's an incredible talent, technically so proficient, obviously great eye for a pass. He
grafts,
yeah, really industrious. That's the word I was going to use. It really industrious. He really grafts. He goes for the press. He's trying to do all the right things. But physically, there's some things that just aren't part of his game. He's 5'7". There's not a lot he can do about that. He's not the fastest player in our team. Sometimes he can't get across. he can't cover the ground quick enough. And I think it compounds some of the issues, as I say, on the right flank, where Trent sometimes is so advanced, and Trent isn't the fastest player in our team either. And then also, that's a side that is under so much scrutiny and is being targeted so repeatedly. So it's almost a bit of a combination of issues down that side. I think Elliot, I look at him and I think in a lot of teams he'd be a winger, but he's not probably fast enough to be a winger in a Jurgen Klopp team. We don't play a 10. So I think we found a role that best suits him, but that's not to say that he's the best player for us in that position currently.
What I would say, though, is I have been impressed with his diligence, because we look at him now, and I think back to the beginning of last season. Last season, all those things, same things were true of him, and every opponent knew it, and they were just bumping off the ball left, right and centre. This season, he's not getting bumped off the ball. Like, he's not able to get to tackles. There's still physical limitations, but I've noticed he's stronger when he's on the ball.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's been clearly gone in the lab and worked at that hard and hard and hard. Yeah. Obviously, Salah's probably helped him on that, I think. So some of the elements of midfielding, the tackling in particular, that he can improve. And if he improves at the rate that he's improving and everything else, I'm less worried. But you're right, there are some things that he literally just not going to... I mean, I don't know if we're going to have any sprint coaches in there, but I don't know how much quicker he could possibly get. So there is always going to be a case of compensation. And like you say, if we're already compensating for some of the things Trent's doing, then it makes it a really difficult situation.
But he's 19.
Yeah,
You know, like none of this is in any way a criticism.
No,
it's not the end of the matter.
No, it's just where his game is at the moment and what we require from our very specific, very unorthodox way of playing football.
Mm-hmm. There is, as part of that, Paul, there is this thing that appears to happen every single time Trent plays a game of football now, which is it's just, I think it's, you know, and watching it yesterday on television, this is a different thing to being in the ground, because you get to see that there's just this almost relentless scrutiny. There's a couple of things here. One, we've just talked about Elliot. Two, as Neil says, every single time he plays, the opposition go that side. Every opposition goes that side.
Yeah.
And there's loads of reasons for that that aren't just Trent Alexander-Arnold. And then number three, what happens to every fullback every time they play a game of football, which is occasionally you come off second best.
Yeah.
That's literally the aim of it.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that happens, and certainly happens yesterday, is he passes the ball like a genius.
Yeah.
Like, some of those passes are mind-boggling when he strikes them.
The cross-field one when he was on the run was incredible. And obviously they mentioned it on commentary, but to be able to pull that off and the technique in doing it was unbelievable. And as you say, he's under constant scrutiny at the moment, isn't he? And then, you know, obviously I think the injuries that are happening to other people. I think Trippier had played really well earlier on, and it was there was all people going on about him. So he's under this constant scrutiny about, is he going to get into the World Cup squad? Now, for us as a Liverpool fans, you know, I couldn't give two monkeys about the World Cup, but in terms of playing and wanting us to have his level of where he was and where he's been playing for the last 3 years. My issue is that he's always going to we're seeing at that point is our weak point, isn't it? And I think Konate playing massively helps him, because obviously you know the level of his game is huge as well, and you felt that if he does get past Trent, or if someone gets past Trent, Konate can come across. And then again, watching the game, I felt there was a need for the scrutiny about the push, because I don't know what people feel around the table. I felt there was nothing in it. I think, okay, he maybe gave an issue by putting his arm out as opposed to his shoulder, but there was a lot of scrutiny on Sky about that. And I was thinking, would it have been like that?
We've all watched a lot of football, haven't we?
Exactly.
We've all seen that a million times.
That's what it felt
a million times.
Like,
no one cries penalty.
Yeah, it felt like they were like an agenda almost. Well, it's Trent again, and that's what.
Well, there is an agenda for two reasons. One, what happened to Cancelo the day before? If that doesn't happen, then that discussion happens a lot shorter. It's like VAR checked it. Continue. The other thing as well, it's one of those incidents where that happens in a certain circle. It's not a foul. Everyone plays on. And the reason everyone plays on is because Ryan Sessegnon's not trying to accentuate the contact in the way that he did. Because essentially, he leaned on him with his hand and Ryan Sessegnon just kind of went and threw himself away in a way that would make it look like on a slow-mo, he was pushed a lot harder. And players are getting wise to the fact that you can do that now. Like, obviously, everything that we do in football is analysed to the nth degree. Everyone's trying to find new angles, new ways of kind of gaming the system. So that's something I've noticed. Like, players have kind of, you know, become movie directors. But with Trent, he is divisive by the nature of the fact that it's almost like he's the dividing line between football knowledge, whereas like if you just look at it and just think all the things he's doing wrong and you have no idea of context of what he's been told to do and the things he's doing right, it's almost like, okay, well, I know how much I can talk to you about football and how much not to. But the thing that I'm comfortable about in all of this whirlwind is him and how he deals with it. If you've heard the interview he did recently where he talks about the people talking about him, He knows that there's most of this chat that he doesn't really need to listen to, doesn't really care about. It's the internal stuff. The people who are telling him inside the coaching stuff, like, this is what we want more of you from. And the ball over the top that they will try to do again and again and again and again. You're right, Neil. It's one of those things where you're going to find clips where he didn't deal with it well simply because it's doing it so many.
Yeah.
And people will put the one clip out there and it'll go around the internet, but they will forget about the 7 or 8 times when he dealt with it. Yep. And he did deal with it really well. I think I even noticed a difference in how he was dealing with it. When he was heading the ball, coming to meet it, he was getting hype rather than just looking to get it away. So it was like, while the ball's in the air, we've got time to reset.
Yep.
And just these little things that clearly someone's had a word with him about. And it's like, if you're still saying, oh yeah, he's not working on his defending, clearly he is working on it.
We saw the Napoli game. You know, Kvaradona, which is, I'm sticking with because I can say it, megs him in the first couple of minutes and absolutely phenomenal attacking footballer, you know, skins him once or twice at the start of the game. And then Trent settles down and has a really good nighty against him. At some point, a winger beats a fullback. Mm. Like you say,
it's their job.
It's their job.
That's their job to go and do it.
You know, yesterday, an England defender made a catastrophic error that led to the critical goal being mm-hmm. scored in the game and his team losing the match. Yeah. His name wasn't fucking Trent Alexander-Arnold.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
exactly.
But ultimately, Liverpool are one of the biggest clubs in the world.
So this, and this one of my things is this is the clicks economy 100 yeah, times. And Trent is now, he's become debate.
Yeah, and I live in the world of clicks.
Yeah.
And Liverpool are one of the biggest clubs in the world. And millions of people love Liverpool and millions of people hate Liverpool. Mm-hmm. And Trent Alexander-Arnold is the perfect topic. And then also, he's the most talented player who might not go to the World Cup with his national team. He might not be part of the team. And all this discourse around England, it's everything that a story, you know, the media want from a story mm-hmm. is encapsulated in this one.
Whereas Eric Dyer's fucking boring.
Yeah. Who cares? Who cares about Eric Dyer?
Yep.
Trent's everything. And part of that is because he's such a fabulous footballer. And we've accentuated his positives and done our best to absolutely eke everything we can out about the best part of his game for so long. And as I was saying earlier, because that's not quite working at the moment, he's looking more vulnerable and we're seeing more of the things that he's not so good at.
Yeah, just quickly, I think Dyer has a good second half, given that how bad his first is. Yeah, I think he really pulls himself around, to be fair to him. I think he really does. I think you can see he's a footballer, if you know what I mean. He passed the ball really nicely.
Yeah.
But we'll talk about one of our footballers who's clearly a footballer. Before we get to the big two, Paul, we'll talk about Konaté. There's a number of things here. One is I actually think in lots of ways this happens sometimes where you're on a bad spell, there's a lad who's been injured, he comes back and he's not staying with any of this bullshit. He's not been part of any of this at all. Like, he doesn't even play Fulham first game. Like, none of all these things that have gone on, they're not my business.
Yeah.
You almost get the impression he's not watched us.
Yeah.
And he's come back in, and it is, I think that helps. But then also, you know, we're now in his second year of being a Liverpool player. So he's took everything that he's learned year one, he's now putting it into year two. He grew through year one anyway. I loved him yesterday. I absolutely loved every minute of him playing football.
Do you know what? At Napoli the other day, he came out and I think I'd just forgotten how big he was. And as he walked on that pitch, I was like, yes, he's just huge. But he's not just huge, he's obviously got pace, he can play, and more importantly, he's a fantastic defender. You mentioned earlier, Neil, about obviously Verge is up this game, and you know, in terms of, you know, what the standard we know he's been at, and he's been playing, you know, better. I think now having Konaté next to him, he just seemed to we laugh about winning battles, and he just seems to do that all the time. Mm. So is it might be an individual duel, or he just seems to, if he needs to do the right thing, he does that. And you know what, I think it's harsh on Joe Gomez, because Joe Gomez was playing really well in some games, but he was just not as consistent as maybe he would have liked and as we would have liked.
On that, Paul, I just want to talk, I think there's a centre-half point here where I think Virgil very much wants to be the Hansen. I think he wants to be the covering centre-half mm-hmm. all the time. And I think when we've seen the other two, both of them, I think that they actually would suit that role a little bit better. Mm-hmm. Now, Matip grown a little bit older, Gomez off the back of the injuries that he's had. I wonder if you're almost better. You know, I feel a little bit like we've almost got three Van Dijks.
Yes.
In the past, I used to think there was only one Van Dijk. And I think there's a little element with the other two now. As I say, Matip's another year older. And he's odd in terms of physical sort of duels anyway, because he's not strong as Konate. Mm-hmm. But he is big, so he can win his headers, et cetera. But he doesn't have that much of a leap on him either. Do you know what I mean? And then Gomez, I think, to me, like, for instance, I hope Gomez plays against Derby and plays left-hand side, and he plays the cover and centre-half role, because I think that could suit him down to the ground.
Yeah.
But that all of a sudden, then, you can end up going, do you know what our most important centre-half is then to keep fit?
Yeah.
It's Ibu Konate.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think we're not far away from that point, as mad as that is, off two games.
Definitely. And I think as well, I don't know whether you feel it, but he seems to be stepping out with the ball a bit more as well. Yeah. I think he, and you know, it was very Matip-like. There was a couple of times where he's done it. He didn't maybe do it as much against Tottenham, but definitely did against Napoli. And to see him doing that, you know, it's a confidence thing, because obviously when you're on the ball, you know, he's there to defend. But then the fact that he's comfortable doing that as well is a massive positive for us as well. And go on, Mum.
We're already there. He's already our most important guy for three reasons. One, he is brave. He's fearless. And at the moment, when you think about the mentality of where the other three are, he's the most fearless. He's the one, like, he knew that Harry Kane is clever enough to say, I don't really want to spend all my day worrying on Virgil. I'm going to go over to this guy because he's still a bit new and I might be able to fool him. And I've got all the refs in my pocket. And he knew that was coming. And he was ready for it. And there were a couple of times where Kane did what Kane does. I mean, the goal he scored was fantastic. He didn't give everyone a sniff. It wasn't like there was a big mistake that caused that goal. It was just bang, bang, bang. Wow, they're really good players. But the next time they got into that situation, what did he do? He was half a yard up quicker on him.
Bit
and he was strong going on to him. And some people tried to make that into a penalty. It was never a penalty.
Oh my
Kane
word.
Fouled him.
Kane does Achilles. Kane does Achilles. I swear to God, Kane knows exactly where his foot is. He knows what he's doing.
I know. But he will never get called on that, because well, that's a whole other show.
England captain.
Yes. The other reason why I think he's so important is because, like Paul said, it's like he recognised the fact that, okay, this team is missing a little bit what Matip gives, that ability to bring the ball out of defence. And he does it. And again, this is part of this fearlessness. He's able to do it, but he's not trying to be Matip. He's doing it in his own way. He's almost like, I'll strive with the ball and then I'll stop here in the middle because I'm strong enough to know that no one's going to get it off me. And then I have a look around. I go, okay, yeah, I'll pass you. And it's just that calmness. And he knows that if someone does get it back to off of him, he can go and get back. He can go and get back. And so there's nothing that he feels that he can't do. And the thing that I love the most about him, there was a moment, maybe through 2 or 3 minutes, where a couple of times he played the ball and it didn't go right, there was one where he tried to block it and it kind of spooned up in the air and he was having a bit of a wobbly 5 minutes and he just shook it off and he just was ready to go again. And I do think, in terms of being able to handle everybody, because like I say, he's going to draw every team's best attacker. They're all going to try it in the same way they all tried to get over on Trent.
And it's the same side.
Yeah. So if we keep him fit for the rest of the season and he plays in every big game, then I think that we are a lot better off.
I thought it was an interesting point you made about the dovetailing with Virgil. It's the aggression in his game, isn't it? And in a way, I used to think that Virgil liked playing with Lovren.
Yeah,
because he could just leave Lovren to just attack everything like a rabid dog. Now with Konate, we've got something very different to Dejan Lovren, because there's a calmness and there's a confidence to his play. He's not rash. He's very cool, and the confidence partly comes from the manager and the faith that's been put in him. Because the Champions League run last year, I think a lot of the time when these big games are coming around, we expected Joel Matip to come back into the defence. And I thought, we're playing Konate in the early rounds of the Champions League, Matip will come in for the big games, but he didn't. You know, big ties against, Man City at Wembley, Konate was the one who started. Mm. The Champions League final, he's our standout performer.
Yeah. Mm.
He's impeccable in that final, and it's lost because of all the reasons, everything that goes on. We're not really dwelling on his performance and quite how impressive it was in a European Cup final against Real Madrid.
Mm. Well, he's going to get a chance to show that again, isn't he?
And again, like I was saying about how big he is a massive threat, you know, when we've got set pieces as well. You know, you mentioned the City one where he's heading above the defence and he scores, doesn't he, in the first few minutes. So we've got that as well in this game. And you both mentioned as well, and you put on the aggression, although he's calm, Neil, you're right, But he's a front foot defender. He wants to go and win that ball, and he does it in an aggressive way, but as you say, in a calm way. Mm. Fantastic.
I think just on the set piece thing, I think if you just be, you know, if you play Nunez as well, suddenly Nunez is the third one you're marking. You've got to deal with Virgil. You've got to deal with Canate. Canate first. Suddenly now you've got, he's now your third one.
Yeah.
What that means is that Fabinho, if he goes up for it, he's your fourth one. He's 6'3".
Yeah, yeah.
This stuff has knock-on effects.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's something which, you know, it can just sort of really open up Liverpool's threats. I'll be honest, it drives me a bit mad. We don't send Gomez up. He's actually there when Carvalho scores against Newcastle.
Yeah.
It's on Gomez's shoulder. Mm-hmm. We send him up with 10 to go. We want him for the pace on the counter. Mm-hmm. There's a massive part of me that at times thinks, just send the centre half up. Let's stop overcomplicating this. But anyway,
I should say the biggest knock-on effect is I've started cheering corners like a Bolton fan.
We're
winning. Genuinely, we win a corner now. I'm really excited.
There's a threat.
Yeah. Get Ibu up straight away.
Yeah, let's see what he does. Neil, let's talk about the big two. It's a great link-up for the goal. Nunez is so present yet again, especially in that first sort of 20 minutes where Tottenham are just... don't know what on earth are we meant to do with this fella. It was interesting. I almost got to the point I felt Basuma, who was an absolute passenger in the game, the one thing he was doing was, I think he was detailed with, can you just help cover over here, because this fella is lightning and we can't get near him. He's terrific. The threat of the two of them is enormous. I've never known threat quite like it with two. It goes back to Suarez and Sturridge in a way, where you look at two lads, both of them could just break 30. They could just both break 30, and that's what you've got to deal with.
Yeah, you've got to deal with him. You've got to deal with the questions he's asking of you time and time again. And again, this is another, he's the story. You know, he's a Liverpool player, the big signing, love him or like him. You know, do you want to concentrate on his positives? Do you want to concentrate on his negatives? I've seen some extraordinary pieces in the aftermath of this game, people criticising him, saying that he's going to be in the lineage of Heskey and Jough and Cissé out on the wing.
Are they classing Heskey and Jough the same, by the way?
Well,
because I've got an issue with that.
Yeah. I mean, who knows?
Emil's looking at his medals right now.
but I think the point they're trying to make is that Liverpool's, you know, signed as centre forwards and have found themselves out on the wing where they're not really fit. That's not what I saw yesterday. I saw an absolute menace.
Sort of siege weapon.
Yeah.
What happened was he was a siege weapon over there between Royale and Dyer. Yeah. And Dyer's at fault for both goals.
Dyer's crying, isn't he? You can see Dyer. He's creaking, thinking, what on earth is this proposition ahead of me? We talk about him being raw. Sometimes his touch is inconsistent. Sometimes he makes the wrong choice. But yesterday, he could easily have had two assists. Mm-hmm. He could have determined the game, as I said earlier, a carbon copy of two... Mm-hmm. Assist for Salah. The two of them are linking up so well. But more than that, he's just a force of nature. I can't think of another way to put it. He's massive.
Yeah.
He's absolutely massive.
And dead fast.
Dead fast. So and hits the ball dead hard.
Yes.
And I'm in favour of all three.
He is the most electrifying man in sports entertainment today. Isn't he, Neil?
Without a shadow of a doubt.
He is the most electrifying man in sports entertainment today.
I just can't understand why people don't enjoy it.
Yeah.
Just enjoy it. It's what we're in it for, isn't it?
And then you've got the pure quality of Mo, which you get to see repeatedly. You get to see for both. I mean, the second goal is just... Lloris, I don't think, covers himself in glory, but simultaneously, my God, he's got a sudden dire problem. He doesn't get to plan this.
Yeah.
But he sees where he is, Mo. He's brilliant.
The thing about I think they did look at it, Sky. It was how, okay, he makes the mistake. And now they made the point that even if Dyer heads that right, it probably could have been risky because Mo's there and he's sniffing, etc. But once he makes the mistake, Mo knows he's probably got two touches here before he's in on goal. And both touches are absolutely brilliant. They're literally exactly where he wants them to be. And then obviously, as you say, maybe Lloris can stand up further. But by that point, he's thinking, what am I going to do here? And Mo just lifts it over him. Mm. It's fantastic. Going back to Nunez as well, Neil, I thought that when it breaks for the first goal, I'm saying it because he does things on the instinct. He's very instinctive. And I want to keep doing that for now. Like the one where he's unlucky, where Lloris saves it early doors on the volley.
Yep.
It's a good save. It's an instinctive strike. So I'm saying, hit that, hit it. Just it seems to be, this is maybe him, you know, as you say, being a bit raw, but he's working on his game. He lays it into Mo fantastically well, but then the way Mo then is touched, that almost sort of puts it into the ground, so then bubbles up, and then he finishes. It was just quality.
It reminded me a little bit, you know, the goal Mo scores at Old Trafford last year. where is it the second one he gets in the first half?
Just a
where
snapshot, he's just like
snapshot,
corner.
Bang, bang. Before you've even thought about it, bang, it's in the back of the net.
Yeah,
you can see the confidence oozing through him now. That second finish is world class as well. That, I mean, Martin Tyler acts like he's come home and found a dead cat. But like, what a goal! What a goal! I mean, they should be eulogising that for the next 5-10 minutes.
I think he's the key to the improvement in this as a partnership as well, because I think the what you were saying, Paul, about the Nunes deciding not to go with his instinct to pass the Mo, that's obviously through discussions. Like Mo was doing a really good job of kind of coaching some players through. We've seen him do it with Harvey.
He loves him.
And I think Salah's also enjoying being in and around century, like being a bit in the 10, around that 10 area as well, and being able to kind of dictate what other people do a little bit. And thinking about how his career is going to change as he gets older, I think he's thought about all of these things, and he sees Nunes as a perfect foil for him to be able to still be able to get in and score goals, but not have to do as much of the other work to maybe keep him there for a bit longer. And they've both bought into it. It's like Mo's like, okay, I need this guy to work for us, and Nunes is like, right, okay, I need to find out how this guy works and kind of fit around it, because whoever we are, the opponents are all still going to be most focused on Salah. Like, as much as this guy is pure chaos in a bag, Salah's still Salah. So they're all still going to be working out what they want to do with him. In the meantime, if he can use that to work out what he's going to do, work out where his space lies, and Mo's obviously going to help him with that, then yeah, you're right. This could be Suarez, Sturridge, just they actually like each other.
And within that as well, you've got the idea that Jota's 15 minimum, and if he gets back, you know, he can go, he scored at the rate of a 15-20 goal season person. Diaz, we hope to see added more goals.
Jota as well, I think, makes such a difference defensively. That's the thing for me, is that we're still not with Bobby tiring on the hour in a lot of these games.
I don't think he plays well again. I don't think he plays well.
I thought he was poor. I thought that the two changes we made were the right changes, and I felt both of them could have come 10
minutes earlier.
I think he was waiting to see, what are you going to do first? Yeah. And then Kulusevski has such an immediate impact, looks like we've been caught on the hop. But I think, you know, we're 2-0 up, we're almost going, what are you going to do? And I think Conte's hanging on a little bit as well, because he's going, well, what are you going to do? And I think there was maybe a bit too much of that, because firstly, you got 5. Let's remember, you know, it felt very much like you haven't got 5, but you got 5. And I agree, I think it could have come early, but I wonder if that's something that they'll reflect on and think, you know what, we don't actually have to hang on. If you sort of know what I mean. But in the moment, literally, you know, time ticks on, and you're managing this team, and also they're doing fine enough. It's still, you know, it's a funny one, really, I think, where I wonder if it's the sort of stuff you'd have a chat about during the World Cup. Could we do this a bit differently, But I simultaneously agree, but also, you're in the moment of the football manager.
It's easy for me sat on my sofa.
And it is the thing that every football supporter will always say, change it. As though changing it will only ever prove to be positive. There's no examples of, e.g., James Milner coming on Goodison Park once and basically kicking it into touch 9 times.
That's one of the greatest, i.e. worst sub performances I've ever seen.
It's tremendous. Genuinely. I think about it about at least once a week. Do you remember when Milner came on at Goodison Park and it was mad? We're all having a lovely time, because the Reds have made it be a lovely time. Everyone didn't play brilliantly, but we still won. And it leaves the picture where a weekend where Manchester United have dropped points, Chelsea have dropped points, Tottenham have dropped points, and it's Liverpool, Newcastle who are in the picture for this now, whether we like it or not. Arsenal and City, obviously, around that top four situation. And Andy, have you got me the whole Champions League draw?
I do.
Go on.
I do. I feel like Chris Evans is producer.
Yep.
So we've got Man City, you've got Brighton, Hove Albion. Bruges, Benfica, obviously we've got Madrid. Milan, Spurs, interesting. Yep. Eintracht Frankfurt, Napoli. Dortmund, Chelsea.
Wow.
The Mourinho derby. Inter, we've got Porto.
Oh.
And then PSG, Bayern.
I mean, narrative.
If we get through Real Madrid.
That's what I'm saying. Look at the teams that are going to go out. Just need to make sure it's not us.
Oh, man.
That draw can open up very, very nicely indeed. Okay, marvellous stuff there. Derby then. Neil Docking, pick me a team. Come on.
It's not easy.
You're on your sofa. You called the manager out. You're on his case. Pick me a team. Well, Jürgen's listening to this thinking, come on, dickhead, it's so easy. Let's see you go.
Well, I want to see Kelleher.
Yeah.
Simikas.
Yeah.
Gomez.
Yeah.
Virgil's played so many minutes.
I think it's Gomez Phillips.
Yeah. I think that Phillips comes in. Yeah, I think
you've got to play
kept him. He's got to play it.
You've got to let him have run round on the grass.
New right back. Would you put
Carl Ramsey? Yeah,
Cam Ramsey.
Yeah, maybe Ramsey. Yeah. Why not? Yeah. So I got the back five there. I didn't think I would.
well done.
Pajicic.
Yep.
Where are we going from here? Milner, where's Milner's concussion?
So the expectation is he'll be fine come Wednesday.
Okay, lovely. I'm delighted to hear that. Straight Milner, straight in. It becomes a bit trickier then, just because there aren't that many bodies. Yeah. Obviously, you've got to find a way to get Carvalho onto the pitch.
Yeah. So you could go Jones in midfield next to Milner, Carvalho off one side, and Chamberlain.
Features. Chamberlain, yeah. I think Ox has got to start too. So it's obviously an entirely changed team almost, but I think that's what's required.
Well, the key thing about this, and I'll say this for our listeners as well, Derby are mid-table in League One. Yeah. They're not a championship team anymore. No. They're mid-table.
Which I thought they were when the draw was made.
And everyone did, because in your head they've just been a championship team for so long. They are now mid-table in League One.
Yeah.
And that is worth bearing in mind. I think, and I could be very wrong, I think one of Salah and Nunez starts.
Okay.
Because I think it gives shape to everything else. So I think one of them starts, and then maybe they just swap. Maybe it's just 45 and 45 or something, but I think one of them starts. Because if you've got Carvalho on one flank, Chamberlain on the other, and you've got behind then Milner and Jones, someone's got to come and play number nine here just to help. And it might be that he goes with Firmino, because he's just running Firmino and running Firmino and running Firmino. But I think you've got to...
I'm not sure this is another one for Bobby.
No, well, so I don't think it's fair on Bobby at this point. Yeah. And also, you might want him against Southampton.
Indeed.
Yeah, I agree. I look at... Our under-21s have been doing quite well recently. I wonder if any of them are going to kind of find their way onto the bench and maybe get a longer stint than they would have normally done.
Well, I think Bobby Clark's going to get half an hour somewhere. Yeah.
It's a real shame Kai Gordon's still unfit, because this is his former team, so he'd have been raring to go. But, I mean, I look at, like, Oki Kananir and Ben Doak, and I think, yes, they're very, very, very young, but their tails are up. And like you say, they're playing against a League One team.
I think they're going to be on the bench. Yeah. I think that they'll get on, but I think that they, I think their bench, and then it's what comes from there.
But I mean, I almost feel a little bit sorry for them if we start Salah, like for Derby. It's just like, do they need this in their life?
But it's
Mo Salah won't feel sorry for him.
No, but also Mo, the thing about Mo is that he's about to not play footy for ages.
I just
wonder if there is just a thing where they go, you know what, let's give him a half, and then maybe do something at half time or something, or vice versa. Mm-hmm. I just don't think it's beyond the realms of possibility. Normally I'd say there's like no way Mo Salah plays the League Cup game.
Yeah.
Right now I feel as though probably 1 in 3 chance Mo Salah gets on at the very least in the League Cup game. And normally he won't even be on the bench, you won't even see him. I just sort of think, well, he literally plays this one, he plays against Southampton. And then what? I think Mo himself will be going, can I just play some football?
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
And if there's anything, given all the amount of people offering spares already, there's going to be a lot of kids at the ground on Wednesday night, and those kids deserve to see their Egyptian king.
Yeah, they deserve
honestly,
to see the
hero. They do indeed, honestly. Friends and family stressing everyone out yet again. Well, in the pool, thank you. Gibbons has got a whiteboard out there with 23 different names on, trying to sort everything out, trying to pull the equations together. We're going to beat them, aren't we? We're going to go through.
Yeah, I mean, you would feel, as I say, I think, like you said, you associate the word Derby as this team in the Championship who are probably pushing for promotion, and they're just not. So it's important we know the context of where they are. We should have well enough to beat them.
Derby County, Real Madrid, who the fuck are you trying to kid?
As the song goes. Thank you very much indeed, Andy Heaton, Paul Johnson, Mo Stewart, Neil Docking. We've all been unbelievably upbeat. Do not let Real Madrid get in your head. They're not going to get in mine. Okay, with a bit of luck, the sound is now working. Do let me know on the chat if the sound is now working. With a bit of luck, it will be. It needs to now be edited, because the thing I was saying a second ago was, if you're listening to this as an audio podcast, the Anfield Wrap today, it's our Talking Red show. It's Neil Atkinson and John Gibbons for that. And we're going to be talking about the news that's broken since we recorded the free show, which is that FSG may well have put Liverpool or some aspect of Liverpool up for sale. To sort of go through a few bits and pieces, statement from Fenway Sports Group reads thus: there have been a number of recent changes of ownership and rumours of changes of ownership at EPL clubs, and inevitably we are asked regularly about Fenway Sports Group's ownership in Liverpool. FSG has frequently received expressions of interest from third parties seeking to become shareholders in Liverpool. FSG has said before that, under the right terms and conditions, we would consider new shareholders if it was in the best interest of Liverpool as a club. FSG remains fully committed to the success of Liverpool both on and off the pitch. A lot of this stems from a piece written by David Ornstein, the wonderful David Ornstein, John's mate in The Athletic, about how Liverpool have prepared a sales brochure of some description, a sales presentation. I mean, it's not like a fucking brochure.
It might be.
Maybe it is.
A deck. Apparently there's a deck.
Is there a deck?
Yeah, yeah.
As soon as there's a deck, things are real these days.
Exactly.
Yeah. Have you ever been part of putting a deck together?
Yeah.
Is our media pack a deck?
Yeah, I think it is.
Is that gets called a deck?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, well, we've got a deck. I thought it was a pack. but this is where we find ourselves. Anyway, Liverpool then are, to me, it feels like it's somewhere in the space between the idea of a full sale and the idea of maybe something bigger than the thing that happened with Redbird, John. I think that there's the possibility that it might be a toe in the water, this, but the idea that there is a deck and the idea that there is, that this story's being run, that there are Morgan Stanley and people like that involved, it does suggest to me that if it's a toe in the water, it's more than one toe in the water, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, I think that's fair, and I think, you know, it's funny because, you know, same people you speak to said, well, actually Liverpool have always been for sale in a way, because it was always seen as investments, and so they were always open to the idea of people coming to them and saying, you know, we will take your investments off your hands if you like, but this feels like a little bit more than that, like you're saying, Neil. You know, it feels like there might be interested parties. It feels like that there might be, you know, it might have come to a point where FSG, you know, because they've never took any money out. It's all about business sort of growing the asset, really. And it might be come to a point where you think, well, is this asset now worth as much as it's kind of ever to be, really? So something, I guess, has prompted it. You know, we can all widely speculate, you know, what that sort of might be.
Chelsea,
really.
Quite possibly, because that's a lot of dough.
Yeah, I think the Chelsea one is, you know, will have raised a few eyebrows at the FSG offices,
yep.
if such a thing even exists. You know, the group chat of the
pinging
of the all the owners, you know, people thinking, hang on, I own 2.5% of this, and I didn't think, you know, it might potentially worth something like 4 billion, and so I think the Chelsea thing.
Just on that, John, your point's really interesting, because the thing we talk about, like, well, people talk about John Henry as owning Liverpool or Fenway Sports Group, and we act as though John Henry is obviously homogenous in that he is John Henry, but that Fenway Sports Group are all homogenous as well, whereas they're not. There are a lot of different people, aren't they?
Yeah.
And the idea that there's more than one sort of intelligence at play here at times in amongst the decision making, I think something that gets sort of glossed over to an extent. Like, there's a lot of people who are part of Fenway Sports Group, including LeBron James, supposedly.
Yeah, exactly, and they'll all have different wants and needs, and I think they're happy to be sort of led by John Henry, but I think something like this, you know, when it sort of comes up, you know, like, as you say, like the Chelsea sale, I think they'll be conscious as well that, you know, there's maybe a little bit of a rebuild doing, so have they sort of got the appetite for that? I almost feel like with FSG right now, or with any ownership group for Liverpool, sort of where we're at, if you're committing to the next 1 year, you're almost committing to the next five, if that sort of makes sense. So we are, feels like, at the end of a cycle, sort of, for this team, and, you know, there's all this talk of investment that's going to be needed in the summer, you know, by whoever the owners are. And so I think, you know, it's either, well, are we committed to that? And the prospects of growth sort of there on it, or is it time, you know, a bit like for a manager, really, you know, he's looking at the team and thinking, you know, well, you know, this needs a bit of a rebuild. Am I the right man for this? Because if I'm signing up now, it's for sort of, you know, the foreseeable future, really. And so maybe there's a little bit of that sort of going on as well, and they're thinking, well, have we got the appetite, really, to, you know, there's Newcastle who are now in the mix as well, you know, they likely, you know, doing really well this season, like likely to be, you know, a force. And so the looking at it and thinking, you know, well, it was a top six, now maybe it's a top seven. We need to be spending all this money. And do we really want to do that? Have we got the energy for it? You know, they came to win, they've won, they've got the title after 30 years. I'm not saying that they haven't got the energy for it.
Yep.
I'm just saying I understand why there's a bit of a conversation at the moment. And if there is someone who's willing to come in and give them 10, maybe even 15 times what they paid for it, then, you know, it doesn't shock you that at least they're having the conversation.
And this appears to be about the conversation. It's, unless there is someone who is literally just waiting in the wings, and this is one of those things where the news is being drip-fed, it's possible. I think there's basically two things here, that or it's the toe in the water, if you sort of see what I mean. And that's where we are in the comparisons between all of these. It's that, it's one or the other, isn't it, John, on this one? I think we'll find out which one it is across the next couple of days. I.e., if it doesn't move fast, it could well move slow. If you sort of see where I'm coming from. And then from there, you know, there is then the conversation around what are they looking for from a shareholder. They've already got Redbird, and I think that Redbird sort of get overlooked. I think they own about 11% at the moment, Redbird. So it's Fenway Sports Group with 89, Redbird with about 11 at the moment as well. And Redbird Redbird are very into meteorites as well. The whole thing is, it is a moment, isn't it, where everyone's going to be trying to work out what the reality is in terms of what it is that Fenway want at this point, and whether or not it is an additional shareholder who can maybe be part of that burden in terms of any further investment into the team, or is it the full out?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really fair, Neil, because I think, you know, what are FSG after and how complicated sort of that is, you know, means, well, knock has the knock-on effect of how long this thing's going to take. And a straight sale's almost easier, you know, isn't it really? You saw that, you know, Abramovich decided he was done, he was out, you know, it's who's going to be paying me this amount of money for this? And it almost turned into a bit of an auction, didn't it? And there was, you know, there was people looking at it all, it was chosen. And so even the way FSG, you know, took over was actually quite quick in the end. I mean, it didn't feel like it, you know, at the time, for those of us who sort of lived through it. But the actual process of them eventually sort of buying the football club was quite quick. So I think if FSG is saying, look, we're willing to be completely out here at the right price, it might happen, it might end up sort of happening quite quickly, because I was really surprised how many big offers Chelsea had. You know, who's paying £4 billion for the football club, but apparently a lot of people are sort of willing to do it. And there was
these days.
Exactly. And so I think if there's, I think if their position is we're willing to go away and say ta-ra at the right price, I think something like that could quite happen quite quickly. If what they're more willing to, and their statement was leading towards this, although, you know, it was a bit of a sort of confusing statement anyway. You know, you're trying to sort of read into it and trying to look at it from a PR perspective and blah, blah, blah. But if they're leaning towards, which a statement sort of is suggesting, you know, either someone coming, another minority shareholder, or them becoming the minority shareholder and someone else sort of leaning on it, I think that's a more complex thing, and it was something that would take a little bit longer and also might not happen. So it might be a case of, well, you know, we want this sort of thing. They get into sort of negotiations, and then in the end, you know, it doesn't sort of end up happening. So if it's that, then I think it might not necessarily get a little bit messy, because I think the football club will just crack on regardless. But I think it might be a more drawn-out process.
It's Liverpool, so it's different to Chelsea. It's Liverpool, so it's different to everyone else. There's other connotations around Liverpool. Liverpool are a worldwide story, if they are indeed on the market. John, it's going to throw us back to a fundamental question, a question on which I've been quite vocal down the years, which is who should or shouldn't run football clubs. There isn't legislation in place, there's nothing statutory around who should or shouldn't run football clubs. There is a fit and proper person test, which, or whatever it's now called, which doesn't seem to be worth much of the paper that it's written on. It being Liverpool, both from our point of view, but also in the way in which it's reported on, does make it, I think, more complicated as to who can come in and buy these shares, to be quite honest with you, if it's a substantial amount. I don't think that bit's that straightforward from a Liverpool point of view. But as I say, I'd always return to the first principles of there's lots of people in this country who own football clubs who I don't think should be allowed to run football clubs. I can even make that argument around Fenway Sports Group. You could argue that people shouldn't be able to come in from overseas and own a football club in this country. You know, you can reach that point if you want to go down this route. But that's what's going to make this complicated, because it being Liverpool means it's different.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy to think that the Steve Morgan, you know, nearly bought, yep, Liverpool Football Club at one point. You know, the idea of a local fella done good, if you like, sort of, you know, buying the football team and putting money in, it just seems sort of so outdated now. It is untrue. I mean, there might be, you know, very, very wealthy people sort of, you know, from the area, brought up in the area, who might be able to pull a consortium together. I don't know, but it does feel like it's going to be something else. If it is a new ownership, and what that something else is, you know, remains to be seen. You know, there's a couple of things on what you were talking about there, Neil, about, you know, the sort of type of owners, and I think it's who's willing to buy and who's willing to buy into us and all that, really. And I think people will look at Liverpool Football Club as an asset, but also will be aware of how much we kick off. Do you know what I mean? From a point of view of, you know, if you're just looking to make as much money as possible from a football club, I don't think we're necessarily
go somewhere else,
because I don't think, and that's not me just, you know, wishful thinking. I think that's just sort of been proved, really, that, you know, every time that, you know, you look at how we've gone up against FSG, you know, on things like the European Super League, on sort of other matters as well. Yeah, just three or four things, the trademark of the word Liverpool and stuff like that. There's a lot of examples to sort of show that it's actually, you know, it's actually a fairly difficult thing when you bring too much capitalism, you know, into this very sort of capitalist thing now. But if it's sort of too upfront, and so I think being Liverpool sort of, you know, and the way we are, I think would weed out a bit of a sort of type of ownership. But I think also there's the point of view of who would FSG be willing to do business with, and that's a really interesting thing because they've been very vocal on how they think sports should run, how they think sports should clubs should run. So are they going to, you know, be looking at it from a point of view? Would they be willing to sell to a nation state effectively? Now you might say, well, the model suggested do, but if someone's offering an extra £500 million. On top of another thing, then how much is that worth?
Yeah, well, in amongst all of that, I think, and this is where it is going to, if it is a full sale, and the point about this is that it might not be a full sale, it might not be that's what Fenway Sports Group want, but if it is a full sale, I think it does throw open a ton of questions. There is now written into the Articles of Association, and it's interesting that's happened quite quickly about the shadow board.
Yeah.
That's actually happened in the last sort of 6 months. It would have been the easiest thing in the world, I think, for the ownership to just kick the can down the road a little bit on that. Not much, but like enough to get to this point. Mm. If they felt that was going to sort of skew things a little bit. I mean, Jesus Christ, I bet you everyone on that sports shadow board's having an afternoon as much as we are as well. But there is within that, isn't there? You know, that does put certain protections in amongst the football club. It has been written into the Articles of Association, so it would have to be written out, which again would add layers of controversy. It would add an obvious kickoff point, frankly, you know, in amongst all of this. And this is where I'm intrigued by what happens next. I think there'll be a lot of people who've wanted, for instance, a change of ownership for a while, who may well be very, very excited by what happens next. I'm not, for a couple of reasons, because, you know, it's quite easy for this sort of stuff to go badly wrong. It's also quite easy for this sort of stuff to be dragged out.
Yeah.
And all of that, none of that, I think, is good around the club at the moment. I think if there's one thing we could do with it, it's surety everywhere, but especially in areas like this.
No, you're right, Neil. And I think, you know, I understand the criticisms of FSG, don't get me wrong, and I've criticised loads of things that they've done, but I also look around the Premier League at the moment and think, well, which owners, you know, would I rather have, and there's sort of very few, really. Even Leicester City's owners, who I used to think was a bit of a model, like, he looks like he's lost a bit of interest, really. Obviously, it was his dad's thing, and he sort of took over, and there was all that tragedy. But you know, that shows the worry when it is someone who's doing it, you know, for pure enjoyment and to give something to the area. If they get a bit bored, then this is sort of that can happen, really. And so I think, you know, I wouldn't personally want us, and I know, you know, I've seen lots of people tweeting the same, you know, owned by this, you know, an investment fund of a nation state, effectively, that wouldn't sort of sit right with me at all. You know, Arsenal are doing very well at the moment, but they've had, you know, huge, you know, owner protests and sort of things like that. We don't know what this Chelsea fella, you know, is up to sort of at the moment, but he sort of seems a bit mad. I can't be bothered with someone who wants to put themselves sort of front and centre of the whole thing, and I say that as a committed show-off.
Yeah.
You know, no, you don't want some prick like me.
Absolutely not. You're on my list of no's. The size of the kickoff. The only thing that's been fair to you is if you get involved, the kickoff will just start in pokes. We'll go from there. You can't look at pokes anymore. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so it's when you do look around and think, well, what kind of ownership, you know, is realistic and is possible and is always sort of there, it does make you a little, anyone who isn't apprehensive, I think, is slightly naive.
The next phase of this is, as repeat, there's loads and loads of stuff in the comments. There's almost everything that you've ever wanted to hear about any topic in the comments all the way through this. There's been recently the Project Big Picture bit, there's been the European Super League bit, there's the ongoing sort of, it's interesting that this has come out the same day, it's obviously purely coincidental that City have announced the biggest ever commercial results that anyone's ever announced.
Good on that commercial team.
Honestly, the fucking hardest working men in show business, they really are.
Unbelievable what they pull together.
I just can't get over them. I think they're spectacular in everything that they do. I won't have a word said against them, John.
No, the creativity that they work through, the doors they can open.
All over the world and in one specific place, loads. loads.
Found the niche.
But I wonder if whether or not, again, the next sort of phase of this from an FSG point of view is sort of looking and going, well, the FFP thing's never quite happened, and we're projecting that it's never quite going to happen. We, you know, we've looked at, there are a couple of changes on the horizon with UEFA in terms of what's counted and how it's counted, and it does look like they're having another go, don't get me wrong, but it may well be that, you know, when they came in, a lot of it was based on the idea that they thought that there would be financial fair play. There isn't.
Yeah.
And they may well have just sort of thought to themselves, we're banging our heads here. But again, this could just be all as part of a sale of some shares, not all the shares. But it is interesting in that context, and as I say, with the City results today. today.
No, definitely. And listen, we were going to, well, we still probably are, we were looking at shows for the World Cup and we were looking at doing these things called the big questions. And one of the ones that we were going to do for the free Monday show was on FSG and have a big chat, you know, as the time sort of allows, which often isn't the case because we're playing sort of twice a week, to look at, you know, the ownership of FSG. And I've been thinking about the show. I don't even know if I was going to be on it yet or not.
We haven't worked that bit out, have we?
Well, we haven't worked that out, but I was thinking, if I am on it, what will I say? And I think the conclusion sort of I got to with it with FSG and whether they think, you know, is almost whether they've been good owners or not is almost irrelevant now. It's whether we think they're the right owners to take us forward from here. And that's sort of where I was ending up when I was having to think about FSG and what I sort of think about them. Because we are a little bit of a crossroads sort of at the moment. And so, listen, I'm fine to have a debate or have a chat or have an argument or just a conversation around FSG's ownership up to this point. And I think, you know, it's interesting to sort of get different views on that and where they've done well and where they haven't and what aspect of our success are they responsible for. And I think that, you know, it's an interesting conversation, but almost more relevant to me when I was thinking about this for the show that, as I say, we'll still probably do in a couple of weeks, although it's slightly sort of changed context, is... Well, that's sort of irrelevant anyway. Are they the best people now with everything that's changed to sort of take us forward, really? And I was going to say I'd be interested to know. Well, do they think that they're the best people?
Yeah.
Because I think that's maybe what's happened. That they've looked at it and as they looked at the current situation, the emergence of Newcastle, sort of looking at everything that's going on, you know, as you say, Neil, in sort of into world football, and you know the way prices are going, the way wages are going. And you know, I'd be almost interested to sort of say to them, I was going to say, do you think you're the best owners, you know, for Liverpool over the next 5 years? How are you going to combat with these growing challenges, these different challenges and stuff like that? And I'd love to sort of know. I mean, it's not going to happen. I've never met John Henry, despite what anyone tells you. But I think there might be a little bit of them going, well, actually, we think we've done a really good job with this football club. We've come in, we've achieved what we wanted to. But right now, is this a good time to just back out? And I think that's possibly what's happened.
One of the things, though, that as part of this is obviously if someone was to be coming in and looking at lock, stock, barrel, though, it's different to the way in which it was even in 2010. The club's in a very different position to where it was in 2010. In 2010, it was not too dissimilar to, frankly, the Newcastle takeover, where everyone was so desperate that Ashley goes out. It's understandable to an extent. You celebrate anyone who comes in,
yeah,
if you know what I mean. And there was all the crisis points around Liverpool then in 2010. Where I think this is now different, John, is the feeling of, well, there will actually be, you know, all going through all the comments, there will actually be quite mixed views. Mixed views on what has been, mixed views on what is going to come next, mixed views on what people do or don't want Liverpool to be. It's also in the context of the league win, of Jurgen, of the way in which we positioned ourselves. You know, all of that stuff,
yeah,
is a completely different context. And I think even just beginning to deal with that, it's a lot of work to get through, even at this point as we're sitting here and talking about it. It's a lot of work to get through. It's very different to 2010.
Yeah, it's probably more like the David Moore sale. I mean, the numbers are completely different. So obviously, the numbers have gone through the roof, but it's probably more like the David Moore thing in that I think it is a bit of an emotional sort of decision of am I, you know, David Moore's got to the point where he just didn't think that he had the pockets deep enough to cope with what was sort of coming up, you know, and the greater spending sort of and things like that, really. And he got out almost for the good of the football club. Listen, I'm not saying, yeah, that FSG have the same emotional investments to Liverpool as David Moore's did, because it had been in the family and it was local and why not. But I think there is an emotional investment there. But yeah, I think they enjoy it. I think they enjoy, you know, owning this football club, and I think they've got sort of a lot from it, really. But I think there will be an aspect of them where they're looking at it in a similar sort of way to David Moore's, and looking sort of around and going, you know, have we got the will, the energy, the finances, the pockets deep enough to cope with or to succeed and win, which is basically what they came to do and what they have done, you know, over the next 5 years, really. And also there's the carrot, the big massive carrot of someone dangling a huge return on what they paid for everyone. So they're all going to get weighed in, and that of course will be a factor as well.
What do you think is the most likely situation from this point then? My guess from reading the Ornstein piece, from reading the statement, is that they would like to shift on another, I'm going to say somewhere between 10 and 60% of the company. You know, at the minute, as I say, they own 89, Redbird 11. It really wouldn't surprise me from that, the tone, the idea that the deck does exist, the idea that they've gone to Morgan Stanley. That makes me think that they're open to the idea of somewhere between 10 and 60%. I feel as though they might not want to be all the way out, not least because I think they'll still have their eye on the media rights stuff, which is clearly why Redbird are in and around. It's clearly what underpins some of the European Super League stuff. It is a direction of travel, which I think does make things more valuable in a football sense. They might just want some cash injection. They might just be looking at a looming global, God knows what, possibly recession. That's my instinct. What's yours?
My instinct is that their preference will be to stay involved in some way. I'm just not massively sure what's in it for the buyer. You know, if you're buying 60, 70% of a football club and then you're leading on the investment sort of from that, what are these people doing or hanging around? If we're just potentially going to make money from your work effectively. So I think their idea will be to sort of stay involved. I just think it might end up being a little bit too tricky because aside from their expertise, which they developed from sort of running a kind of a football club really, which, you know, they might think is worth a lot, but someone else might not. Do you know what I mean? Everyone thinks they can run a football club, don't they? And so I think it might just end up, I think they're ideal. They might end up having to sort of scale back from, and it's okay, well, this is the offer. Do you take it or do you don't?
So, here we are. Do we know if Liverpool are up for sale? No. Do we know what number of shares Fenway Sports Group would like to shift on what percentage? No. Do we know that something has happened? It does appear that something has happened, otherwise you wouldn't see the piece in The Athletic. And has anything changed? Is Fenway Sports Group general position being, give us a call? And that maybe they're just sort of advertising that out a little bit more now. That's also very, very possible indeed. But what you do know is that there'll be more and more and more of this on the Anfield Wrap. There may well be the show about Fenway Sports Group, which, as John said, is now a show in a completely different context. That one might be coming as well. There should always be conversations about who should or shouldn't run football clubs in this country. That there aren't is, I think, just a little bit embarrassing, to be honest with you, in the way in which it's gone across the last 15 years is scandalous, and ultimately government should have been involved. And yet again, we sit here, it's interesting, Liverpool have chosen not to back the Crouch Review in many of its different sort of bits and pieces, but trust me when I tell you it is the only way home, it is the only lever we have in town, and so far that hasn't been implemented either by the Premier League. Lots and lots to come on the Anfield Wrap, loads and loads of different bits of this which can be spoken about and will be spoken about. You can download the app, you know where our channels are, you know where our social is, you can subscribe if you want as well. Thank you very much for coming and joining us, thanks for the comments. I was going to go through a fair few bits and pieces of the comments, but you're all saying loads and loads of stuff, and it's going too fast, to be honest with you.
You should have appointed a foreman, like a jury.
Yeah, one of you is just to sort of go from there.
Yeah, have a chat amongst yourselves and tell us what you collectively think.
Yeah, there's now people doing
one individual.
Yeah, there's now people doing. There are now people doing jokes about James Dyson hoovering up the best talent, which, you know, as far as I'm concerned, is he
a runner and rider in all this?
I don't know if he is or not. They keep mentioning the man Katori, who supports both United and Chelsea.
Can't be asked for them.
Absolutely cannot be fucking bothered with that prick. So that means it's probably going to happen in about 20 minutes.
I know. We'll be like, oh yeah, we now welcome our Mag Chelsea overlords.
Oh yeah. Great set of lads. I've always said that about Manchester United and Chelsea supporters who are non-domiciled in this club. Great set of lads, every single one of them. Thank you very much for being part of the whole thing. Download the app. I've done that bit already, haven't I? See ya. Sports Social Podcast Network.